The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. Senator Tom Cotton joins me, the senator from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator Cotton. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning to you. It's good to be back on with you.
I got to cover a lot of stuff with you, but I got to start with the TikTok bill. It's not before you yet. It will be voted on the House tomorrow. I expect it to pass overwhelmingly. When it gets to the Senate, will Senator Tom Cotton support banning or forcing the sale of TikTok from the Chi-Coms?
Yes, Hugh, of course. There's a lot of different bills to regulate TikTok in this country. But clearly, what Congressman Gallagher and his counterparts in the House have done has gotten the widest consensus, and it gets the job done. It's not a ban of TikTok per se. It simply insists that ByteDance, which is a Chinese company that is wholly controlled and influenced by the Chinese Communist Party, must divest TikTok. And it gives them 5 or 6 months to do so. And I'm confident there are many American companies and wealthy investors who would line up for the opportunity to buy TikTok, to make sure it's owned by Americans who are not going to exploit your data for their own purposes or turn it into a propaganda tool of Chinese communism. And Hugh, I think last week when this bill passed committee by a vote of 50-0, which is pretty remarkable, we got a small glimpse and foretaste of what Chinese communists could do with TikTok. TikTok sent push notifications to its users' phones, urging them to call Congress to oppose this bill. Well, Hugh, what do we think TikTok would do if, say, President Trump next year wanted to impose new tariffs on China that would be crippling to the Chinese economy, or at a moment of heightened tensions and potential conflict around Taiwan? This is the exact kind of propaganda risk that I and others have warned about with TikTok for years. So I expect a very large vote in the House tomorrow, and I would urge Chuck Schumer to promptly bring that bill to the floor and pass it so we can get on with the process of forcing a Chinese communist-dominated company to divest from TikTok.
If Senator Schumer were not in any way compromised by TikTok money or by colleagues in his conference who are compromised by TikTok money, how quickly could the House bill get to a vote on the floor of the Senate?
Well, Hugh, I suspect that we'd have to go the long way or the hard way, as we sometimes call it, because we have a few senators who are dug in and they would drag down all the procedures they could. But again, Hugh, the stakes are so high that it's worth taking that time. In short, basically, it would require Senator Schumer probably to file a motion one Tuesday, have a first vote on a Thursday, and then come back the next week, and you'd look at passing that on, say, like Tuesday or Wednesday. And you could do stuff, obviously, in the meantime on the Senate floor. In addition to that legislation. But that's what we call the long way or the hard way. It typically takes about 4 Senate business days. Again, you can do other things. Even if you couldn't, though, it's essential that we take action to get this propaganda tool out of the hands of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, people should call Senator Schumer and be very polite, 202-224-3121, and urge him to please bring this. This is an important national security issue. It's about my grandchildren. It's about Senator Cotton's kids. I do not want them growing up in a world addicted to the TikTok run by the Chi-Coms. It's just I can't even believe we haven't done this.
And, TikTok has an army of lobbyists and lawyers that are trying to muddy the waters or, again, using push notifications to urge its users to call Congress and oppose the legislation, which I have to say is one of the worst own goals I've seen in advocacy work in my 10 years in the Congress. Because, again, all it did was highlight the potential for TikTok to be manipulated by Chinese communists. But, you know, Hugh, it's not just a threat to the United States directly and to our rival with China. You saw also last fall what it meant for anti-Semitism in this country. TikTok continued to promote the most vile kinds of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, to blame Israel for the most vicious attack on Jews since the Holocaust. I suspect Chuck Schumer is personally aggrieved by what TikTok did last fall with Israel. I also suspect he has a lot of voters and supporters in New York State who would be urging him to bring this bill promptly to the floor, because we don't want to continue to let Chinese communists infiltrate our country with anti-Semitic filth that is designed to divide and inflame American opinion.
This is really such an easy, easy vote, and it should move through and it should happen. Now, Senator, I want to go back 5 days to the State of the Union. I did not see you in any of the panning shots. Were you in the chamber?
I was, Hugh. I was there. I said to a colleague next to me as soon as Joe Biden started, one, why is he yelling? And two, why is he talking so fast? I think it's clear that President Biden thought that he needed to go in and be super amped up to dispute all the very valid concerns about his age and infirmity. I also think that, you know, the Democratic Party had kind of put on its game plan to turn it into a campaign rally. I've never seen one side chanting four more years or cheering for the most mundane line. That probably the White House told the House Democrats that the president needs the room to be full of energy to make it through the night. But beyond those oddities of the delivery, Hugh, what you just saw is more of the old school ideological liberalism that is really what's causing Joe Biden's poll numbers to tank. Sure, people know that he's old and infirm, but what they really dislike is the liberal policies that have made their lives so much harder, made the standard of living lower. They brought more crime to this country, opened our borders, made American disrespect in the world. And you just heard more of that at the State of the Union, in addition to a lot of blame shifting for his own problems.
This morning in news items from John Ellis, I found this extraordinary bit. The seven swing states most likely to decide the 2024 presidential election are facing more economic misery than the rest of the U.S., adding an obstacle to President Joe Biden's reelection campaign. The Bloomberg Economic Misery 2 Index, an analysis of cumulative inflation rates over 4 years, plus the latest unemployment rate, illustrates how differing economic conditions across the United States can impact the electoral vote. The index is higher in the battleground states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin than in those that reliably vote either Republican or Democrat in presidential election. Maybe that's why he was yelling so much, Senator, but I said on air, and I'll say it again, I've watched between 40 and 50 of these. That's the only time I've ever been disturbed. I've been inspired. I've been disappointed. I have been alarmed at the ability of the Bill Clinton people to deliver a speech like that. I've never been disturbed. I don't think President Biden is up to this job for four more years. I don't think he's up to it right now. Do you think other people on the other, in your colleagues in the Senate, did they feel sorry for him? Because he really was just shouting.
I can't speak for the Democrats, but I would say that most Republicans feel sorry for the American people, having lived through 3 years of Joe Biden's presidency with another 9 months ahead of us. Because, again, it's not just his age and infirmity. It's the failures of his liberal policies that have caused him to be so unpopular. And I know all the talking heads on CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times were celebrating the fiery Joe Biden out of that speech the other night. Again, I think they got their talking points from the White House to try to allay the ongoing concerns about Joe Biden's ability to campaign and certainly to govern for four more years.
Right.
As you've seen from the polling since the speech Thursday night, it was one of the most poorly received State of the Unions ever.
Yeah, and he's relapsed into terrible campaigning mode, as we saw yesterday in New Hampshire.
Well, yeah, he in an impromptu moment, he acknowledged that Laken Riley's killer was an illegal, even though he referred to her as Lincoln Riley, the USC football coach. And then the next day at Air Force One, he was challenged on that because you had a bunch of lefties, of all things, offended that he had described the murderer as illegal. And the next day he said, well, technically he's not supposed to be here. And then the next day after that, after what I assume was a five-alarm fire in the White House and all the progressive young staffers with their hair on fire about it, he had to go have a sit-down interview with MSNBC to officially apologize to a heinous, brutal murderer for calling him an illegal. If there was ever a moment to show how Joe Biden is dragged around by the nose by the progressive left, that's the moment. When he apologized to an illegal for calling him illegal, even though he's a brutal murderer, versus Donald Trump meeting with that victim's family and promising to get them justice.
Now, Senator, I want to do some breaking news with you. Headline at the Wall Street Journal. Consumer prices rose 3.2% from a year earlier in February. That is much stronger than was expected. We are not beating inflation.
No, we're not, Hugh. There's a time when the Democrats would say, well, if you squint really hard and you look from a certain angle and you exclude food and fuel because they're volatile, and besides, who needs to eat or go anywhere? Inflation is getting under control. Well, now you have those headline numbers, and I haven't seen the exact reports, but for months, so-called core inflation has been even higher.
Yeah, it's 3.8%. Core inflation is 3.8%.
Exactly. And the reason you do that is, granted, food and gas in particular can be more volatile, but other prices tend to show you whether or not inflation has sunk deep into the economy, and it has. If it is at 3.8%, as you say to you, that's almost double what the Federal Reserve's target rate is. Yet you have all these Democrats still demanding that interest rates come down, not because they think inflation is beaten, but because they want it to help Joe Biden's election. It just goes to show how badly Joe Biden's policies have failed the American people, that in year four, after they unleashed inflation with their spending binge in year one, you still have an inflation that is almost double the Federal Reserve's target rate.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you for joining me this morning. Good luck on helping Chuck Schumer see the light and get the TikTok ban done next week and spreading the message about inflation. We have not beaten it. We are not going to get lower interest rates. The president has sent up a budget that is absurd, including a 0.9% increase in defense spending instead of what we need. Thank you, Senator Cotton.
Almost cut my hair.
Welcome back, America. This is a album from 54 years ago, so I'm not sure this will appeal to David Drucker, my guest from the Dispatch. David, are you a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young fan?
Oh, yeah. And I'm old enough that I've heard plenty of it.
All right, good. David, the TikTok bill is going to the House floor tomorrow under the suspension of the rules, meaning it will require a two-thirds vote. Will it pass?
I'm inclined to think it will pass, Hugh. It passed the Energy and Commerce Committee 50-0. I mean, you can't get Democrats and Republicans to agree on what day it is.
Do you ever remember a 50-0 vote in Energy and Commerce? One of the big three committees. I do not ever remember a 50-0 vote.
No. I can't. I've been in Washington 20 years. So, you know, maybe in the glory days of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, not that they didn't have their fights, but I haven't seen bipartisan agreement on something consequential like this in quite a while.
Now, there are lots of reports that TikTok is flooding the Hill with all their bought and paid for lobbyists, and that maybe there'll be trouble in the Senate. I don't know of any senator who wants to be known as the TikTok senator, the senator from TikTok. Do you?
Well, Rand Paul, I think, is happy to be Senator Paul R. TikTok. I mean, look, he's a libertarian-leaning Republican anyway. This thing rankles him. There's been less enthusiastic support for policy like this in the Senate than the House, although broadly speaking, there's not a rejection of it. Look, it's still unclear exactly how the Senate is going to dispose of this. They've had similar proposals, but not quite as strong. Former President Donald Trump has come out against the ban.
And he walked that back a little bit yesterday.
Did
you notice that? He walked it back?
Well, he walks forward and backward on things like this all the time. But, the way he constructed his opposition is something that would help Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, referring to Meta as, quote, the enemy of the people, unquote, means that, this thing is still a little bit delicate in the Senate. Clearly in the House, it hasn't had an effect. What I was told by a source the other day, interestingly enough, Hugh, was that the text of the House bill was taken in large part from a Trump White House executive order from 2019. And so there's certainly something there for Republicans to lean on if they get a little queasy about Trump's comments on TikTok. We'll just have to see.
All right. Now, speaking of Trump, I got a column coming out in the Post today or tomorrow in which I say, look, we need a vice president to contrast with Kamala Harris, not demographically, not from a swing state, but someone who could stand next to Kamala Harris, because we got an 81-year-old nominee, a president, and a 77-year-old nominee. Kamala Harris is given the second place job. We need to contrast. My three are Tom Cotton or Joni Ernst or Mike Pompeo. I understand Ben Carson's on the list. J.D. Vance is on the list. What are you picking up on this thing?
I think it's really hard to tell which direction Trump is going to go, honestly. He loves to treat things like, you know, his old game show, The Apprentice. I think the one thing that's different from 2016 is I don't think Trump, and for obvious reasons, believes that he needs to shore up any particular segment of the Republican Party. I don't think that's necessarily true, but I think he thinks it's true. And so, you know, in 2016, he landed on Mike Pence as somebody who would attract traditional Republicans who were suspicious of him for, you know, for various reasons. And it was a really smart pick in that regard. It was also a pick that helped him deal with Capitol Hill once he was president. I think, you know, the question here is, given that he's going to be a one-term, second-term president, if you will, does he pick somebody that sets up the Republican Party for the 2028 election? And does he provide the age contrast? Donald Trump will be 78 years old on June 14th, I believe it is. Will be into his 80s if he wins in November. Or does he just decide to pick somebody that he likes, that he gets along with, that he feels, you know, is sort of a conservative populist like he is? Or does he go back to the Pence model, which is somebody that appeals to traditional Republicans that don't always like everything he does and says?
My proposition is that the Pence model, you don't need to do that because he came through on the Supreme Court. You do need to contrast with Kamala Harris, because you're actually, if you're voting for Biden, you're voting for Harris, because I can't see him making it 4 years. And that's why I like Cotton, who's young. That's why I like Joni Ernst, who's young. Mike Pompeo's 60. He's in his prime, but they're all very, very serious people. And I know that there's an Elise Stefanik boomlet, too, but I don't think she's got the chops on national security that would contrast with Kamala Harris and her lightheadedness, which is occasionally on display.
I think picking a House member is really problematic, right? I think it's harder for people to see House members as presidential. Paul Ryan obviously was picked by Mitt Romney in 2012. I think he was a little bit of an exception, given the stature he had created for himself in the party on issues and other things. Those three picks, those hail from the traditional wing of the Republican Party. That would tell us that Trump understands he needs to try and recreate his 2016 coalition in order to win.
And they all create excellent contrast with Kamala Harris, and they're all good on the border. They're all very good on the border. David M. Drucker on X with the Dispatch. Always good to see you, David. Derek Anderson.
Hey, Mr. Hewitt. This is Derek Anderson.
It's good to talk to you, Derek. Please call me Hugh. It took me forever to find your website. It's DerekAnderson.com. And I heard last night from my son, who works for Mike Waltz, that you're a winner, you're a Green Beret, and that this district is suddenly very competitive. Tell us where the Virginia 7th is.
Yeah, so Virginia 7 is centrally located in Virginia. I kind of call the focal point Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania, where I grew up. That's the center of the district. But it ranges up I-95 into Stafford and part of Prince William County. And then it goes east over to the Potomac, over near King George and Caroline County, and then goes all the way out to the mountains of the Shenandoah with Madison, Greene, Culpeper, Orange County. So it's one of those microcosm districts where we've got anything from the Potomac up to a little bit of northern Virginia all the way out.
Oh, my goodness. What's the RD split?
Beautiful. I think it's as of last cycle, it was a D plus one, but now that the incumbent is stepping out, it's an open seat. So that, I think that changes the dynamics, certainly.
I think it does, too. Who is retiring from there?
So Abigail Spanberger was the incumbent. She was in that district since 2018. But like I said, she's walking away from the district. I ran in 2022. There's a few other candidates out this cycle that have run before. that are back at it again. As you know, we can't give up the fight. So, I jumped in. I came in second in a 7-way primary last cycle. I was a brand new candidate. I'd never run for anything before in my life. And that was my first time. And now we're back at it again. So we're pretty excited.
I've always been a believer since Senator John Thune lost his first race for Senate that the second time candidates emerge much better than they were the first time. They learn not how to waste time, how to deliver the message, how to raise small dollar donors. People can go to DerekAnderson.com if they want to donate to Derek Anderson. Derek, tell me a little. Let's walk through the bio, because I believe you have 6 combat deployments as a Green Beret. And I know you guys don't like to talk about that, but the audience wants to know about that. When did you join the Army? When did you become a Green Beret, and where did you deploy to?
Yeah, so I grew up in Spotsylvania County. I went into the ROTC program at Virginia Tech, which, you know, was an awesome, awesome program as a young man. It was a great program to kind of get me put on the right path. But I ended up joining the Army. I was an infantry officer. I served with the 3rd Infantry Division after graduating from Ranger School. And I went to Iraq for 15 months as part of the surge back in 2007, 2008. So 15 months was a long time. But I left Iraq, went to the Honor Guard, where I did the funerals in Arlington National Cemetery for about 2 years. And then after that, I got selected for the Special Forces. And then I served as a team leader for 2 Special Forces, 2 Green Beret teams. And I did 5 deployments with them. So I went to Lebanon, Israel, Bahrain, Jordan, Afghanistan. So I did 5 deployments with them before leaving the Army after 10 plus years. And then I went to law school after that and clerked for 2 federal judges. So
which judges did you clerk for? I'm curious about that, because that's not your normal clerk path. Normally you got all these kids who just came out of, they went right from college to law school. They're 3 years out of law school, so they're 23 or 24, and they end up clerking on the D.C. Circuit or somewhere. And they're all geeks, and they're all about 25. So you're a little bit different. Who'd you clerk for?
So President Trump had nominated a gentleman by the name of Patrick Bumate on the 9th Circuit. That was my first clerkship that I did. He's a originalist, textualist, a great, great human being that really kind of set me on my pathway when it comes to my legal philosophy. And then I clerked in the Eastern District of Virginia for Judge Anthony Tringa.
Well, that's very smart. You have to get that 9th Circuit washed off of you. I've been practicing in the 9th Circuit for 30. I'm retired now, but I got to tell you, you got to get the stink of the 9th Circuit washed off of you before you go be a real lawyer somewhere. Now, Derek,
wrote a lot of dissents, needless to say.
I'll bet
on the 9th Circuit.
I'll bet, but that's a heck of a lot of good experience running for Congress. You sound a lot like Cotton, who also went to Ranger School, also deployed in the surge, though he was 101st, and you were with the 3rd. Was in the old guard. That's quite a career. Have you got Cotton and Pompeo and Waltz and all the gang, the Special Forces gang, on your side in this primary?
Yeah, so Mike Waltz and Senator Cotton have both endorsed me in my campaign. So there's a funny hysterical story. Senator Cotton and I actually overlapped in our time in the old guard. Senator Cotton was out the door as I was coming in. I was training for the best ranger competition at the time, and I remember sitting on the porch of one of the older buildings on Fort Myer, and I saw this really, really, really tall guy walk by, and I was like, "Who's this guy?" And I was talking to a few of my enlisted soldiers. I was like, this guy's tall. Like, who is this guy?" And they're like, "He's going to be a congressman or a senator one day. You know, he went to Harvard Law School. This that, and the other." And I was like, "No, I don't know who this guy is. Like, no way. And sure as heck, Senator Cotton is now Senator Cotton. But yeah, Senator Cotton and Mike Waltz have been very, very big supporters of me and my campaign. Mike always jokes with me and tells me, "Hey, we need more Green Berets." I saw Pat Harrigan recently. He's another Green Beret that's running in North Carolina. He just won his primary. Knock on wood, he is going to be one of the next congressmen from North Carolina. So us Green Berets are coming out of the woodworks. We're ready to get.
Waltz has been pretty lonely. There are a bunch of SEALs up there, but the Army Special Forces are underrepresented, and there are too many Marines to begin with, but we need some more Green Berets. So, Derek, as you make your way around this vast district, what is on the minds? I live up in Alexandria area, so I'm in the inside the Beltway. You're outside of the Beltway. And I think it's two different states. I really do. I think it's completely two different states. What's on the mind of people in the middle of the state?
Yeah, so when you look at Central Virginia, like there are certainly some of the issues that we see nationally that are affecting us. You know, I-95 comes right through the middle of our district, right? So we have some of the issues with just infrastructure generally. We see a lot of issues right now. One of the big ones I would say that traveling the district that we see all the time is the economy. You know, when you go to the grocery store, there's a Walmart and a Giant next to my house. And, you know, we see the fact that when you go and buy eggs, that it's $5 a carton of eggs. And that doesn't sit kindly with people, and people are not able to afford basic things. You know, it's not that they're trying to go on a fancy trip or go on a fancy dinner. It's costing a lot just to live. The border is affecting our district as well. You know, I speak a lot with the local sheriffs, specifically in Stafford County. There's a sheriff that I speak to all the time. They're doing a great job of a community on community relationship to ensure that, you know, they can keep that crime down. But at the same time, we see that I-95 corridor, and it is a problem, whether it's fentanyl, whether it's crime, all of the things that one can imagine that comes with an open border. But one of the other things I take personally to heart that, you know, I go to some of our gun shows, I go to a lot of local events, and I run into a lot of veterans. And, you know, veterans issues are a thing. And we're building one of the largest super clinics in our district here in Spotsylvania County. That's going to be able to tend to the needs of some of our veterans. They don't have to go to D.C. or Richmond. Granted, it's not an overnight facility. It's a facility that can take care of their needs, though. So VA issues are another big issue that we see in our district.
Did any of those veterans complain to you, Derek Anderson, about the KISS photograph that the some bureaucrat took down and the secretary of the VA had to order put back up of the Navy sailor kissing a young lady? And it's in my Washington Post column. It's coming out. It just tells me that the VA is still clueless. Did anyone ever complain to you about that photo?
Absolutely. Not that they complained about the photo. They complained about the issue that surrounded the photo, if that makes more sense, Hugh. I mean, we look at what our veterans are supposed to go to the VA hospital, get the medical care, mental, physical, whatever it is, and instead, you know, the VA has made their focal point on this photo, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, that the photo is a bastion. It's a representation of our community, or, you know, post-World War II. You know, it shows that people were happy. People were happy about winning a war that, you know, the war of all wars, you know.
The representation of victory. Did you have a reaction when the Gold Star dad was arrested at the State of the Union for shouting out Abbey Gate?
Yeah, I was, you know, it hits hard with me. I lost several of my Green Berets and some of our soldiers in Afghanistan. And so when I saw the father, the Gold Star father, and his reactions, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm here. This is one of the reasons why I'm running for Congress, was what happened in Afghanistan several years ago. You know, I understand and feel that father, that Gold Star father's, I empathize with him. You know, he's upset. He's ticked off that, you know, President Biden won't even acknowledge what happened in Afghanistan several years ago. You know, when
I really believe that the new greatest generation has to replace the old greatest generation. We've had a gap, and that we're filling that gap with veterans like you, Derek Anderson. Tell me quickly, how much money do you have to raise for that race?
So, you know, we've raised a good amount. We're leading on the Republican primary side. We've raised just a little under $500,000 so far. But, you know, this is going to be one of the most expensive races in the nation. I'm pretty sure that I've spoken to some folks that said that this is this is going to be in the tens of millions of dollar race. It's one of the top two races in the nation. So needless to say, it's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of work to win this seat. But, you know, we're excited about jumping in. But it is going to be one of the more expensive races in the entire nation.
If people want to help Derek Anderson, go to Derek Anderson, two R's in the DerekAnderson.com. Derek Anderson, you can follow him on X as well, at Derek for VA. Welcome back, America. In the Buckeye State next week, I think it's next Tuesday, there will be a primary, and Frank LaRose will be one of the three primary candidates who's on the ballot for the Republican nomination for Senate. Matt Dolan, Frank LaRose, Bernie Marino. It's a hard-fought three-way race, and I'm joined by Frank LaRose now for the closing argument. Frank, when is the vote actually happening in the Buckeye State?
Well, the vote is happening right now, quite honestly, because early voting is still underway all of this week until Sunday. But Election Day is next Tuesday, March 19th.
Okay, Frank, give the pitch. Tell people why they should pick Frank LaRose.
Well, first of all, we've got to beat Sherrod Brown. He's been hard to beat. This is probably the most resilient Democrat in Ohio, and I'm the one that can beat him. I'm the only one that's ever won a statewide election of this field of three Republicans that are running. But even more important than beating him is that we've got to replace him with a credentialed conservative, somebody that we know is going to run into battle. In that sense, I'm the only real proven conservative in this race. I am up against two very wealthy, self-funding opponents that are desperately trying to convince Ohioans that they are conservatives, but Ohioans aren't buying it. They know that I'm the one that has the pro-life voting record, the pro-Second Amendment voting record, and a real focus on getting our economy back on track through free market principles. They also know that I'll be the first Green Beret to ever serve in the Senate in U.S. history. I think that special ops experience is going to be valuable.
You know, we have back-to-back Green Berets. Derek Anderson's running for Congress in Virginia, followed by Frank LaRose, Green Beret. Where's your heartland of strength in the Buckeye strength? Is it northeastern Ohio? Is it central Ohio? Where is it for Frank LaRose?
Well, I'm born and raised in Northeast Ohio, just like you, Hugh, but I have a lot of strength there. But I have campaigned all over Ohio for the last 6 years as the Secretary of State and traveled around the state. And so really, my strength is statewide, and Ohio conservatives know they can trust me because I don't just say it, I do it. They've seen me, again, go into battle to fight for their values.
Now, this is one of those elections where every single vote counts. What do you expect turnout to be on Tuesday?
Unfortunately, we think it's going to be low. As the Secretary of State, I always want to see turnout as high as possible. But what we're seeing in early vote numbers is a very low number of early voters. And I think that that is going to continue through Election Day. But listen, this is because a lot of us who have long been supporters of Donald Trump, a lot of my fellow Ohioans look across the presidential election and say, well, this thing's over. Trump's got it in the bag. We got to remind Ohioans that it's important that they get out and vote, because what you're choosing is your party's standard bearer for the U.S. Senate. And this is the seat that will determine the Senate majority next year.
Now, there were two debates, maybe three, and I was originally offered a chance to do that, and the Republican Party of Ohio pulled back that invite. How did those debates go? Did you get asked left-wing questions by left-wing questioners, which is what I thought would happen?
Yeah, to some extent. They would have been better if you had been the moderator, Hugh. I was hoping for that. Of course, this is something that was negotiated by the party. What it was really is a contrast. You saw Dolan, who's kind of a pretty far-left liberal. You saw Bernie, who was really just kind of squirming to try to convince people that he was a conservative, even though he has a long record of being for gun control, being for green energy mandates. He sat on a board that gave $2 million to Planned Parenthood, and he's trying to convince people that he's a conservative. And then you saw me standing there talking about how we're actually going to put this country back on track.
Now, Frank LaRose, as Secretary of State, have you had any controversies, any big wins, anything that you are campaigning on specifically?
Well, I'm the guy that keeps Ohio's elections honest. I was the only Secretary of State in America to earn Trump's endorsement in 2022 because of the way Ohio runs elections. We make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. There have been no scandals, certainly. And I'm proud of the fact that during the 2020 election, which was an epic, difficult election, that Ohio shined. We gave you those results on election night, and Ohio knew they could trust them. We had a 99.98% accuracy rate when we audited the election, which we audit every election. And so Ohioans know that I would be a champion for election integrity in the U.S. Senate as well. In fact, I've helped Congress write a bill called the ACE Act, American Confidence in Elections. It's got 200 co-sponsors in the House. It's So it's going to pass there, but it'll languish and die in Chuck Schumer's Senate unless you've got a champion like me there and unless we take back the majority to help get that done so that the other 49 states can learn from Ohio's example.
Closing argument, Frank LaRose, why should people get out and vote early or vote for you next Tuesday for the Republican nomination for Senate?
Bottom line is we have a country to save. I took an oath when I was 18, and that oath included, by the way, the unwritten promise that I love this country so much I'm willing to die for it. This country is in jeopardy, and if it's worth dying for, and I believe wholeheartedly it is, it's also worth living for. I continue to serve to this day as a reservist. I'll be the only member of the Senate who still wears the uniform. And I think that it's time that we return this country to a position of strength. I can stand with President Trump to get that done, secure the border, restore parents' rights, and put our economy back on track.
Where's the website, Frank LaRose?
Right here, franklarose.com. Maybe consider chipping in a couple bucks for us. I'm the only guy in the race that can't self-fund. We've had a lot of Ohioans that have done just that, but I'd be honored to earn your support today.
FrankLaRose.com. Thank you, Frank. Good luck next week. I'm going to have all three candidates on to make their closing argument. Frank gets to do it during early voting. Wasn't aware of that, but that's fine. We're fair. Thank you, Frank. Be well and go Browns. I'll be right back. America, they resigned Zadarius Smith yesterday, so I'm a happy man. Very happy man. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. A couple of years ago, there was The Real Deal, a genuine, unexpected, runaway New York Times bestseller. And I say that because there are very infrequently unexpected runaway New York Times bestseller. But the book 2034 by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander, and Elliot Ackerman actually was an unexpected runaway New York Times bestseller. And at the time, I said, we need more. And they came up with 2054, which drops today. And I welcome back Admiral Stav and Elliot Ackerman to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Congratulations, gentlemen. Admiral, let me start with you. Your publisher blew it. They sent it to Virginia, not California, so I haven't read it yet. I get it on Saturday. How's it being received by people like me who love 2034?
So far, so good. There certainly is a lot of enthusiasm. And the reason, Hugh, is because we move on from 2034, great power competition, a war with the U.S. and China. Now it's 2054, set mid-century. Artificial intelligence, geopolitics continue. And as the novel opens, a president falls over dead at a campaign event. Who killed him? How is artificial intelligence involved? It all unspools in the course of this novel.
Well, that's a good opening. Elliot, you and the Admiral are very accomplished authors. You're also veterans. How do you work together on a novel like this? Because 2034 was a big win. 2054 is going to come out number one on the New York Times. How do you work with each other?
You know, we outline these books, you know, where we align on exactly what's going to happen in terms of the story. You know, we do a lot of back and forth, and then we sort of go chapter by chapter. So someone usually takes a first crack at the chapter, and that's me. And then I hand it to the Admiral, you know, with certain gaps, you know, like an enormous naval battle happens here, or we say something interesting about artificial intelligence here. And we just sort of go chapter by chapter, batting them back and forth. And that's sort of how we've been working on this series. It's going to be a trilogy.
Now, you are at the frontier of warfare when you bring up artificial intelligence, the singularity. I assume that you've got supercomputing involved in this as well as biowarfare, Admiral. Which one did you need to learn the most about and which was the most difficult to master?
Yeah, what a great question. The thing I needed to learn the most about was the bio side of this. As you'd probably expect, I've been coding since I was in my 20s. I've always been seized with cybersecurity. The technology side was very comfortable, certainly the warfare side. But to learn about the biological side and how these two things come together is really at the heart of the learning process in putting this together.
Elliot, let me ask you, in terms of the Navy of 2054, the United States Navy, do we still have carriers or have we decided that they've gone the way of the battleship?
Well, I think what you certainly see is that aircraft carriers are no longer so central in our U.S. naval strategy. And what we do is we take current trends and extrapolate them outwards. And we're seeing those trends right now in places like Ukraine, where half of Russia's Black Sea fleet has been basically compromised by a Ukrainian Navy that has no capital ships, but is reliant on surface drones.
So, Admiral, how big is our Navy in 2054? The president's budget went up with a 0.9% increase, and we're down to one Virginia class this year. What's the Navy in 2054 looking like? Do we continue to shrink the fleet?
I'm going to cross my fingers and hope boldly that our naval fleet has expanded to be capable of meeting global responsibilities, which clearly it's not today. We've only got 290 ships. China has 350 and is building more. We're decommissioning too many. We've got serious work to do. But here's the punchline. By 2054, the Navy is going to be dispersed, more swarms, more unmanned, linked to space, perhaps using some of these biological tools, all of it lashed together by artificial intelligence. It'll look quite different, but ultimately one thing won't change, and that's geography. 70% of this planet is water. Goods will move by water. We need to control the oceans of the world.
I'm hoping you gentlemen come back next week after I've had a chance to read this. But, Elliot, I got to ask you one question before we get away. Are you afraid of AI? You know, you're going to have to deal with this. The Admiral and I will go to our rewards before AI fully unfolds in the world. Maybe not, but certainly you will be dealing with it for the rest of your life. Does it make you stay awake at night?
I wouldn't say that I'm afraid of AI, because I don't think being afraid of it is useful. I mean, this is the future. And I think what is incumbent upon us is, and what we try to do in 2054, is to extrapolate where that future is taking us. And I think it'll be enormous opportunities that present themselves with artificial intelligence, but also enormous challenges. And we outlined some of those challenges in 2054, particularly as they relate to also our politics at home.
Well, I touched down Saturday night at 9, and I assume by Sunday night I'll be deep into 2054, and I congratulate you gentlemen. We'll talk again next week. I am hoping to actually get my arms around AI via, this is where fiction matters so much, 2054, if it's anything like 2034, is going to rock the bestseller list. Go out and get your copy today. It's available at Amazon, of course, at all bookstores. It'll be in the airport. I may actually buy a book, which is against my every bone in a radio host body, so I can read it on the airplane on Saturday. Congratulations, Admiral Stab and Elliot. I'll talk to you again next week about 2054. Maybe I'll even listen to it. 2054 available today. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, Generalissimo. Talk to you tomorrow, everyone, on the next Hugh Hewitt Show, and I'll be on Special Report tonight.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.